Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off today. Late Friday, as Hurricane Harvey was starting to slam into the Texas coast, President Trump pardoned former Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Arpaio, a controversial and polarizing octogenarian, won the attention of the nation for his years-long crackdown on illegal immigration, which critics say was racially biased. In 2011, he was told by a federal judge he could not apprehend immigrants just because they didn't have legal status, but his office continued to do so regardless. And this summer, Arpaio was convicted of criminal contempt. Arpaio has been a supporter of President Trump from the very beginning, and Mr. Trump had hinted at a pardon recently, and Friday night the president issued that pardon without apology for the timing of the act as the nation's eyes were turned to Harvey.
Well, a lot of people think it was the right thing to do, John, and actually in the middle of a hurricane, even though it was a Friday evening, I assumed the ratings would be far higher than they would be normally. You know, the hurricane was just starting. And I put it out that I had pardoned, as we say, Sheriff Joe. He's done a great job for the people of Arizona. He's very strong on borders, very strong on illegal immigration. He is loved in Arizona. I thought he was treated unbelievably unfairly when they came down with their big decision to go get him right before the election voting started.
And that was President Trump speaking on Monday night. What are the implications of this decision as the nation continues to grapple with the challenges of immigration? Let us know what you think. Here's the number, 888-477-9499. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times or an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And joining us now for some analysis, Antonia Farzan is a journalist with the Phoenix New Times. Welcome to Radio Times, Antonia. Do we have Antonia with us? All right. She will be joining us hopefully via Skype in just a moment or so. Mike Riggs writes for Reason Magazine. Hi, Mike. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for having me on.
Sure. So, Mike, what do you make of the timing of President Trump's announcement?
I have not covered Arpaio religiously, although I've written about him off and on over the years. So I will defer to my peer in Arizona on this. But in terms of how the pardon system generally works, has historically worked under both Democratic and Republican presidents, Arpaio's pardon is exceptional in all the wrong ways. He was not sentenced yet. Sentencing doesn't happen until October. While most pardon applicants have to wait until 5 years after they've finished serving whatever sentence they have, he is not apologetic. He is not remorseful. So in lots of ways, this is just totally bizarre and inappropriate.
All right. And we do have Antonia Farzan with us now. Welcome to Radio Times, Antonia.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, Antonia, I just asked Mike this question. What do you make of the timing of President Trump's announcement?
Well, what we heard a lot of people saying when we were calling them on Friday night was that they find it to be completely cowardly that he would do it at 5 p.m. Arizona time on a Friday, 8 p.m. in Washington, and as a major hurricane was headed for Texas. A lot of people got the impression that he was trying to somehow bury it and have people not notice, but I can tell you it didn't work. Everyone was still talking about it here on Monday morning, so definitely did not slide under the radar if that is what he was trying to accomplish. Although with that weird comment about the ratings, it seems like apparently not.
Okay, let's get to the nuts and bolts of the pardon. Once again, back to you, Mike. We've actually got a comment which came in pretty quickly from Jane. She says, it's okay to call him convicted criminal, Arpaio, because it's true. So exactly what does a pardon do for somebody?
So a pardon is kind of like a presidential act of forgiveness. It's not an exoneration. You don't get a pardon because you didn't actually commit the crime for which you were convicted. It is not an expungement. You still have a criminal record, and the White House maintains a record of everyone who's received a pardon and what crime they were pardoned for. So it basically just, there's some restoration of federal civil rights that comes with it. And then there's also just this general seal of approval that says, yes, I committed a crime, but I have, I have reformed myself to such a degree that the highest power in the country has said, yeah, you're all better now. You deserve to have your, to be restored to your rightful place in society.
And we were talking about how unusual this pardon is on a number of levels. You know, they often come, presidential pardons, in the final days of a presidency, but also the Justice Department usually weighs in before the pardon is issued. Did this happen here, Mike?
Our bio didn't even request a pardon or apply for a pardon. I'm guessing someone may have weighed in somewhere in this process, maybe Attorney General Sessions, but it certainly did not go through the normal channels, which is an application is sent to the Office of the Pardon Attorney that is read by a career staffer. It has been siphoned up to the pardon attorney themselves. Then it goes to the Deputy Attorney General. Then it goes to the Attorney General. Then it'll go to White House Counsel. And then once every person there has said, yeah, this fits the historical standards for granting a pardon and won't expose us politically, it then goes to the president. And while I think there are lots of ways in which both pardons and commutations, which are the two forms of executive clemency, could be a lot better, could be a lot more fair and a lot more transparent, Arpaio's pardon is a departure in the wrong direction.
Antonio Frazan, Arpaio has been accused by critics of creating a culture of racial profiling in his efforts to detain people whose legal status in the U.S. is uncertain. Tell us more about what you have heard on the personal level in your reporting.
A lot of people have been describing it as a slap in the face. That's what we've been hearing over and over again from people who dealt with his racial profiling, which is pretty much anyone with darker skin or who spoke Spanish in Arizona. The Department of Justice, when they investigated in 2011, said that he had conducted the worst racial profiling in U.S. history, which is quite a claim. And a lot of people really remember kind of as an era of terror. I mean, one thing that really stuck out to me, Raquel Teran, who's a Latino community organizer here in Arizona, told the Arizona Republic that you'd have second graders who would be worried that Sheriff Joe was going to come and take away their parents. And she pointed out, I mean, for a second grader to know the name of their county sheriff, that's pretty unusual. And that really tells you just how all-encompassing that atmosphere of fear was.
And he apparently didn't, you know, just go after poor undocumented immigrants, as you wrote earlier this year, Antonia. Former Maricopa County Supervisor Andy, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, is it Kunasek? Can be counted among the people bullied and abused by the ex-sheriff, along with judges and lawyers.
Yeah, and actually the former owners of the Phoenix New Times, where I work, were hauled out of their houses by deputies in the middle of the night and locked up because he didn't like some reporting we had done on him. So he absolutely made a point of going after his political enemies, hired a private investigator to investigate the judge who charged him with contempt of court and the judge's wife. So, yeah, really a lot of abuse of power, not just of, you know, typically powerless people.
Mike Riggs, the image of Joe Arpaio is that of a strong man. And this is a personality type that President Trump seems to admire?
Clearly, and also someone who has shown fealty to Trump, which is, I think, what Trump admires most, maybe in the entire world, is people who tell him nice things about himself. And I definitely get the sense from everything that Trump has said that he does not understand the magnitude of the power he wields in pretty much any arena of governance, from tweets about North Korea to claims that, you know, could jeopardize international relations with Mexico. And this is just one more place where somebody said something to Trump that he thought was flattering, and somebody else told him, hey, if you do this, the kind of people who show up at your rallies will cheer for you. And so I think for him it was a relatively simple political calculation. Granted, one that would be made by just an incredible narcissist, but there was probably some calculation behind it.
We've got calls and comments coming in, 888-477-9499, and let's get right to the phones. Rob in Springfield, Pennsylvania, you are live with us on Radio Times. Hello, Rob.
Hi, thanks for having me. So two things. One, I think anyone who is a Trump supporter and claims they believe in the rule of law really needs to look at this more closely, because this really is a gigantic problem. To the bigger story here, I think everyone's missing, which is you know, this pardon of Arpaio, as detestable as he is, really is a signal or a dog whistle to everyone who's being investigated and in connection with Trump that don't worry about it. You'll be pardoned.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And as we're coming up to a break here, Rob, let me ask our guests what they think. Thank you so much for your call to Radio Times. So, you know, really the question has been raised, Antonio, what next with the pardon of Joe Arpaio and in unusual circumstances? What are we looking at down the road from the president? What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think it's definitely true that it is sending a signal to law enforcement and definitely saying, you know, it doesn't matter if you break the law, it doesn't matter if you violate the Constitution. In fact, yesterday in Phoenix, we had on their lunch break, a bunch of lawyers, about 150 people gathered outside the federal courthouse and held a protest. They called it a vigil for the rule of law. So, and those are not necessarily civil rights and immigration lawyers. Those are people who deal with taxes and stuff who are really concerned about how this looks and the message it sends.
So now on the other side, the Trump White House has essentially said, you know, look at other presidential actions. For instance, you know, earlier this year, then President Obama commuted the sentence of Chelsea Manning. That was quite controversial. And that means her sentence was shortened. Her conviction still stands. She was not pardoned. She was found guilty of leaking information that revealed, you know, American military and diplomatic activities. And, you know, Republican Senator John McCain says her actions put American troops at risk. So, you know, what are your thoughts on that? You know, Mr. Trump perhaps is not the, well, certainly is not the first president to make a controversial pardon or commutation. What do you think, Mike?
No, this is true. And you can look back at President Bill Clinton's pardon of Mark Rich, who fled the U.S. in 1984 and never even returned to stand trial. But I think the Arpaio pardon is more like Mark Rich than it is like Chelsea Manning. And certainly it is nothing like the overall progress of Obama's clemency initiative, which sought to reduce the sentences of nonviolent drug offenders who had been, in some cases, given de facto life sentences, but otherwise 20, 30 years. Manning spent time in solitary confinement. She was in a federal prison. She was locked naked in a cell for 23 hours a day with very little human contact because she was at various times considered a threat to herself, which she was only considered a threat to herself because she was deprived adequate medical care. You know, I am a big believer that we exact far too much of people we can convict in the criminal justice system in this country. Chelsea Manning gave her pound of flesh. I do not think that we should send an 85-year-old man to federal prison. I actually don't think Arpaio is the private individual is a threat to public safety, and I think that's what incarceration is for. But he is not remorseful. He is not apologetic. This has always been a fundamental criterion for getting executive clemency, whether it's commutation or as a pardon, is that you admit guilt, that you apologize, that you make amends.
Mike, we're going to pick up on that line of thought as soon as we get past the break here. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia, and we're talking for the next few minutes about the pardoning by President Trump of former Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moscawane. And for the next few minutes on Radio Times, we'll be talking about the pardoning Friday by President Trump of former Sheriff Joe Arpaio, which happened much to the chagrin of many Democrats and Republicans. We are joined for the next few minutes again by Mike Riggs, reporter for Reason Magazine, and Antonio Farzan, who reports for the Phoenix New Times. And again, picking up on what Mike was saying going into the break, Antonia, regarding what would have been the possible imprisonment of Joe Arpaio, do we know what he could have faced behind bars? Do you have a sense of this? And is it clear that he might have been put in with the general prison population?
Yeah, I don't think anyone was really expecting that he was ever going to serve a single day of those 6 months, to be honest. Just a month ago, when the guilty verdict came out, I was out getting the reaction to that, and everyone kept saying, well, you know, I'd love to see him go to Tent City and experience the same conditions that he put people in his jail through. Realistically, he would have gone to a much more cushy federal facility, kind of like the kind that Martha Stewart went to. Probably would have been able to get off because of his age. So no one's really surprised that this is happening. Definitely, you know, something that everyone saw coming, that it would be at least shortened. Probably wouldn't have done the whole 6 months, if a single day.
Okay, there, and we have to go there for a moment or so here. There was Arpaio's reported inhumane treatment of prisoners, as you mentioned, Antonia, Tent City, chain gangs. Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. Hundreds of prisoners died on his watch in county jails, and at a far higher rate than other cities, even with a larger jail size. It got to be really expensive. I think wrongful death lawsuits at this point have cost the county over $40 million, which is a large part of why he was voted out in November. You had women giving birth to stillborn babies in jail because of the inhumane treatment they faced. You had people being kept outside in tents where the temperature reached 140 degrees, where their shoes started to melt. I can go on for as long as you'll let me.
He was voted out, and yet he was also in office for six terms. So, you know, with all that was ostensibly going on, why'd it take so long?
Yeah, it really is remarkable. And honestly, it is interesting to look that he was elected, voted out the same time that Trump was elected. So what you're seeing is conservative voters just got tired of how much he was costing the county. And yes, certainly there was more mobilization of the Latino vote that helped get him out of office. But really, I mean, for a long time, people did not care about what he was doing to prisoners and what he was doing to undocumented people. It was only once they started paying for it as taxpayers that they started saying, hang on, I don't like what's happening here.
Back to the phones we go. Randy in Levittown. Welcome to Radio Times, Randy.
Oh, yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, it's a shame that it has to go like that, but, I mean, ultimately, if people are here illegally, something has to be done. I mean, like, I did a flea market in South Jersey, and I'm not telling you, there's, like, thousands of illegal immigrants. I'm assuming they are.
You know what? I'm going to ask Randy to call back. I don't know about our listeners, but I'm having a hard time hearing you, Randy. So if you could give us a quick call back, and we'll try to reestablish that line, that would be great. Let's go back to Mike Riggs now. What has been the response, Mike, from Arizona lawmakers on the state and federal levels to the president's pardon?
Senators Flake and McCain, Jeff Flake and John McCain, I think are both pretty upset about this. They both released statements saying they essentially wish Trump hadn't done it and that it felt like interference in the normal proceedings of the federal court system, which it absolutely is. Again, we don't ever see pardons, and with the exception of Mark Rich, who never stood trial but did spend essentially 20 years in exile, we do not see pardons prior to sentencing. Never. I mean, this is so bizarre, and I think that Senators Flake and McCain were both upset by the extent to which this was a breach of protocol, but also that Trump is creating problems for them in Arizona. Although Flake should probably expect far more of that as he has in 2018.
Speaking of Senator Flake, Joe Arpaio has kind of been making some noises, I guess, about perhaps running for office on any number of level, local, state, perhaps even running against Jeff Flake, who's up for re-election next year. He's 85 years old, obviously carries a lot of baggage. So do you expect to see him in office somewhere in the political scene in the near future? Mike, you first.
I'm going to have to defer to Antonia here because it just seems impossible to me. It seems impossible, but then, he was sheriff of Maricopa County, a super important county in Arizona for six terms, and that is also seems like it should be impossible.
Antonia, what do you think?
Yeah, well, he's been saying he's going to run for higher office for 20 years. Has never done it. The difference now is that he's unemployed, so presumably he has the time. But I'll believe it when I see it. And I'm not talking about him filing paperwork, but I'm saying I actually want to see him holding campaign events and going door to door. What we do know is that he has a lot of legal bills to pay. It makes sense that he would float a run as a way of, raising some money. But there is a high level of skepticism here, and I'm certainly going to need to see a lot more evidence that he's running before I start covering it as a serious race.
Mike, you've written that Attorney General Jeff Sessions does not see eye to eye with the president on this.
He shouldn't, based on his own history of criticizing pretty much all executive clemency action. As a senator, Jeff Sessions opposed the Rich pardon for a good cause, but he also fought President Obama on his clemency initiative the entire way. He fought any sort of criminal justice reform that would have introduced more proportional sentences into the federal drug mandatory minimum system. He's rejected improving prison conditions. He has rejected improving rehabilitation services for convicted people. So really, he has not demonstrated himself to be a merciful man. Yet, from what I can tell, he has remained, you know, completely silent about Arpaio. And may not have even been consulted. I have no idea if he was consulted.
Okay, thanks for clearing that up. So Antonia, looking ahead, in Maricopa County, the head of the migrant justice advocacy group called Puente Arizona says as long as ICE is in control, it's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Arpaio is still in control. Do you see that there might be some truth to this?
Yeah, I mean, right now what's going on is that anyone who is held in the Maricopa County Jail gets a detainer and gets turned over to ICE, and that is what gets the vast majority of people deported from Phoenix. It's not raids anymore. We haven't seen that happening so far this year. So definitely we are seeing organizations like Puente looking at the new Sheriff Pinzon with a critical eye. And, you know, he did inherit Arpaio's guys, so he is going to have a lot to do to clean up the department. And people have a higher expectation for him than just not being Arpaio.
And who is Pinzon?
He challenged Arpaio this past year as a Democrat, and he was able to win with some help from Republicans because of how much Arpaio was costing.
So perhaps a new page for Maricopa County?
Yeah, we'll see. We're definitely looking at it and planning to hold him accountable the same way we did Arpaio.
All right, Antonia Farzan, thank you so much for joining us this hour of Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Antonia Farzan is a journalist with the Phoenix New Times. And Mike Riggs, good to have you with us as well.
Thank you very much.
Mike Riggs writes for Reason Magazine. So we turn our attention now to the program known as Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. DACA, as it's called, is observing its fifth anniversary, but any celebration might be short-lived. President Trump is thinking about pulling the plug on DACA, as some in his administration are urging him to do. And we are expecting an announcement on this in the very near future. Here with us now to give us a close look at the program and the politics behind it is Elise Foley, politics and immigration reporter for The Huffington Post. Welcome to Radio Times, Elise.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So give us a quick sense of what DACA has accomplished in its 5 years of existence.
Sure. So, as you said, it started in 2012. And basically what it does is it allows people who came to the U.S. As children before they were 16 and are under a certain age as of the time that it was created to apply to get a 2-year work permit and some deportation reprieve. So none of it is a guarantee. It can be revoked from people. But for that 2-year period, they don't have to be, you know, so worried about getting picked up by ICE. They can do live their lives in a little bit easier of a manner, and they can work, which is a huge, huge thing for people, obviously, working legally. So this has been granted so far to nearly 800,000 people. A lot of them at this stage are now renewing it, have renewed it maybe even more than once. So it's just had a, you know, huge, huge effect on a lot of people's lives.
You say it has been life-changing for many of its recipients.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of people who were never able to get a driver's license before, and now they can drive, and were never able to work legally, and now they can work legally. So if this gets taken away, that's going to hugely, hugely affect their lives as well. It'll be life-changing in the other direction.
So, Elise Foley, President Trump has kept protections in place for dreamers, as they're called. He has seemed to be sympathetic to them while in office. However, you know, earlier on the campaign trail, he was decidedly against keeping DACA in place. How do you parse this?
Well, I think that the problem for Republicans is that as much as they dislike the program because of the way Obama started it. They said that it was unconstitutional and he had no right to create it, that it was amnesty, et cetera. Once it actually comes down to taking away protections from people, I think that that is something that's a lot harder. So especially with Dreamers, they've really done just a really, you know, it's kind of fascinating job at shaping the perception of what a Dreamer looks like into being, you know, these people who are came as kids, you know, no fault of their own, are trying to contribute to the community. And they've gotten that message out there really, really well. And so it's even to Republican voters, not that appealing an idea to take a bunch of these people and put them at risk of deportation. So you've kind of got the opposition to DACA running up against this reluctance to actually do something that would mean deporting more Dreamers, which I think would be something that a lot of Republican voters wouldn't want either. So I think they would kind of rather not deal with it, but they're in a position where they have to.
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia, and we have switched gears, now turning talking about Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, and the Dreamers, and the fact that President Trump is considering whether to continue the program. Our guest right now is Elise Foley, immigration and politics reporter for Huffington Post. In a little bit, we'll be joined by Maria Sotomayor, who is not only the deputy director of Pennsylvania Immigration and Citizens Coalition, but she's also a DACA recipient. And if you'd like to jump into the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So Attorney General Jeff Sessions, longtime critic of DACA, Elise, he says DACA is unconstitutional. And you'd mentioned this view a little bit earlier. On what grounds is it unconstitutional in their minds?
Well, they say that it's not something the president can do to provide this type of relief on such a massive level. So the president, or, you know, more so the Department of Homeland Security and lower, they are able to grant deferred action on a case-by-case basis. But what the people who say this is unconstitutional argue is that this takes it a lot farther, and it's doing this for an entire class of people. It is granted on a case-by-case basis. They do review each person individually, which is why the people who support it say that it is constitutional. But that's the basic argument, is that it's just too sweeping. Isn't something that a president can do. It needs to be done by legislation, according to people like Jeff Sessions.
So a number of state attorneys general have set a deadline for next Tuesday for the Trump administration to end DACA, or they will take legal action. What actions are they considering, and how many states are involved here?
It is 10 states led by Texas. Texas also led the lawsuit that ended up blocking President Obama's second deferred action effort, which was aimed at parents and also would have expanded DACA. So what they want to do is try to amend that lawsuit, which, even though it, you know, went all the way to the Supreme Court, actually has not yet been fully resolved. They want to add this suit against the full DACA program to this previous legal action they've done. So
is that Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, DAPA?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So that was blocked. That's now been rescinded. It no longer, you know, exists. But
do we still have Elise? I think we might have lost her for the moment. We are going to try to get Elise Foley back by phone. She is the immigration and politics reporter for the Huffington Post. And in just a few minutes, we will be joined by Maria Sotomayor, who is a DACA recipient and also deputy director of the Pennsylvania Immigration and Citizenship Coalition. We are talking about deferred action for childhood arrivals, folks who participate, young people popularly known as the Dreamers. DACA has observed its fifth anniversary. However, not sure how much longer the program will be around. President Trump is considering whether to end DACA or end as some in his administration want him to do. And as Elise Foley and I were just talking about a moment ago, 10 state attorneys general from 10 states say they will sue or take legal action if the president does not decide to end DACA and make that decision before next Tuesday. So we were talking about, Elise, before we lost you there for a moment, the program called Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, which was, you know, is not in place at this point. And the fact that, I guess, some who are thinking about the court action, including Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, might use this precedent in challenging DACA. Do I have you correct? Do I have this correct there? All right. Not sure we have Elise back. We thought we did. We're still working on that connection. But again, what do you think? The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, is said to have done an awful lot for young people who participate, the Dreamers, the undocumented immigrants who arrived in this country as children, allowing them to work legally for a renewable two-year period. At the time, they are protected from deportation, and this has affected the lives of nearly 800,000 people. So we're trying to get Elise Foley of Huffington Post back. I'm going to ask her about what happens should the plug be pulled from DACA. And also, again, we're taking your calls. 888-477-9499 is the number to call. If you've got an opinion, if you've got some thoughts, give us a call. Otherwise, you can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And we're going to get to some phone calls as soon as we come back from our break. This is WHYY. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. More on the DACA program just ahead. Keep it here. And thank you so much for listening. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We are talking for the remainder of the program today about the DACA program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. President Trump is expected to make an announcement soon about the fate of this program. And we have Elise Foley back now. She is immigration and politics reporter for Huffington Post. Welcome back, Elise.
Hi, sorry about that.
Oh, that's all right. And also joining us is Maria Sotomayor. She is deputy director of the Pennsylvania Immigration and Citizenship Coalition and is also a Dreamer, becoming a recipient of DACA in 2012. Maria, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
So to you first, Maria, tell us a bit about yourself. How old were you when you came to the United States, and why did your family decide to bring you here?
So I was about 10 years old when I came to the U.S., and my family came to this country because of a lot of economic issues, but also to give my sister and I a better life and better education.
And staying in Ecuador then would have meant exactly what for your family? What sort of life?
Well, they were definitely struggling, but they wanted to make sure that we were able to go to school and have a career, so they didn't have to, so we didn't have to split our families apart in the future doing the same thing as they had to do. So they were trying to end that cycle of family separation, and so they decided to bring us to the U.S.
So what has DACA meant to you, Maria?
DACA meant a lot to me. I was able to obtain a work permit and also protection against deportation, which to me, you know, I was attending college at the time when DACA was announced, and every time that I drove or even in school, I would always fear that ICE could potentially come and get me at any time. Because DACA gave me a protection against deportation, I felt it was more secure. But I've also felt like a lot of my family and friends have been left behind because they weren't able to qualify for DACA. So I wanted to, it also gave me another way to keep on fighting and being more vocal about the situation and how we need to defend and protect all immigrants.
So I, as I understand it, Maria, you are married. You do have your green card. But so in this current political climate, what about the rest of your family?
Yeah, so it's been really hard because, yeah, now I have this new advantage, right, and privilege being a permanent resident now. But I am afraid for all of my other family members who aren't documented yet and who have to worry so much about what could happen or who, if they get pulled over or if they're in the streets and there's immigration in the streets or something like that. It is terrifying.
So back to you, Elise Foley, as we were going into the break, we were talking about efforts of some states, some state attorneys general to sue, or I should say to go to court, if the Trump administration does not decide to drop DACA. And we were talking about Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, who I think wants to take a page from the demise of DAPA, the Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, and apply this to DACA. If you could just briefly tell us what the plan there, the game plan is there, and what are the odds for success?
Sure. So what they said was that they think that Trump should end the program. They said it doesn't mean that they wrote a letter to the administration. They said it doesn't mean that they have to go out and deport the Dreamers. They can just let these permits expire. But if he doesn't do it, then they will amend this lawsuit that they have for DAPA so that they can add the DACA element. And they're hoping that the same arguments that helped them end DAPA will prevail with DACA and that they will be able to get the program blocked in full, which would completely end the program. One interesting element is it would also, potentially create this precedent where presidents did not have the level of power that the Obama administration said that they did have on immigration. So if the administration, this administration, doesn't defend it in court, if it comes to that, then they could be potentially limiting presidential powers on this in the future. So it'll be a really interesting question whether the administration even does defend it, if Texas does this at all, which is obviously a big question.
So if the permits are allowed to expire DACA recipients, the Dreamers, are they left vulnerable then, Elise?
Yeah, absolutely. So they would, the administration has said over and over that their focus is criminals. But at the same time, people have been detained who are non-criminals if ICE, runs into them. So ICE could go to somebody's house looking for somebody else and then pick up somebody who they weren't going to look for. And it happens all the time. I wrote about a DACA recipient recently who went to ICE to help pay bond for somebody in her church. She has DACA, so she had these protections, but she still got detained for a week because they made an error. So those types of things, if people come into ICE contact in some way, they're at a risk for deportation. And if people didn't have DACA, whether they're criminals who ICE is going after or not, they would be at a very great risk.
Maria,
and not to mention, ICE has the government has all their information.
Again, Maria, you are Deputy Director of the Pennsylvania Immigration and Citizenship Coalition. What are you telling people? What are you advising young people who are part of DACA, but who might be wondering what the next step should be because of uncertainty surrounding the program? What are you telling them?
Right. So as of now, we just want to make sure that people understand what's going on. So either visiting our website because we're posting updates. We have also had many calls with our young people to just keep them updated. The other thing that we're advising right now is just if they have to reapply for their DACA or applying for the first time, just to hold off for a little bit, just to see what happens.
So don't try to get in now. Don't try to get in under the deadline.
Right now, we're just advising that they should just wait a little bit to see if there's anything happens in the next week or so. So they don't lose their money, basically. Mm-hmm. The other thing is to seek legal advice and to be careful of notary fraud and also immigration fraud as well. Since when things like this happen, there's a lot of people who take advantage of the immigrant community, and they want to make money because of things like this. So that's one of the biggest things that we're telling people. Keep updated as well.
And keep in touch with your group.
Yeah, keep in touch with our organization. Check out our website for any updates. And also, there will be a lot of, we're currently organizing a lot of our immigrant community groups and partners around the state to be able to provide space and also Know Your Rights sessions.
Let's get to the phones once again. Trevor is in Montgomery County, and you are now joining us live on Radio Times. Trevor, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks. What's your question or comment?
So I just wanted to raise another issue that I haven't heard talked about a lot. I have several friends that are attending both Montgomery County Community College and Temple University, and they are under DACA, and they pay taxes and work here for years and years, and they receive out-of-state tuition, which is a big deal considering it's a difference of like $12,000 in-state and $24,000 at Temple out-of-state, which is a make or break for a lot of these people that are stand-up tax-paying citizens that are friends and neighbors. It really puts a financial burden and limits their potential to strive in this country.
Trevor, we're losing you, but we get the gist of what you're saying. Maria, what are the parameters about, you know, DACA recipients who want to go on to higher education? Does it vary state to state? Do some receive in-state tuition depending on where they are? What's that look like?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So right now, there are about 22 states that have a tuition equity bill. Unfortunately, Pennsylvania doesn't have one, which makes it a lot harder for undocumented students to be able to continue their education because they're being charged as out of state, as he mentioned, or international rates, so double or triple, and that's without being able to apply for any financial aid, right, because DACA or undocumented immigrants do not qualify for that type of aid. And so right now we're actually fighting to pass a tuition equity bill here in Pennsylvania. And so my one recommendation is for young people and also allies to get involved with that, to be able to contact their representatives and ask them to support tuition equity statewide.
We've got a tweet from Matthew who asks, is there talk of organizing should this happen, and meaning should DACA be dropped? Hopefully there would be a huge grassroots backlash defending these people. And Elise, you know, advocacy groups like United We Dream say they will fight. Realistically, what can these groups do? What can a grassroots effort do?
Well, I think that there are multiple things. So right now they're advocating for Trump to not end the program at all, and they say that that's their top focus. But in the event that Trump does end the program, I think that you'll see different community groups and churches maybe offering sanctuary to people. And I think the big focus will probably be on Congress. All along, if Congress wanted to, they could pass a bill that would give Dreamers long-term protections. You know, there's the Dream Act, which is what Dreamers are named for, that would give them a path to citizenship. There are other things that would be more of a stopgap measure. So I think that the real fight will turn to Congress to do something, to act to protect DACA recipients. And that'll be what the big advocacy push will be.
Now, the legislation hasn't gotten very far that has been there. I mean, do you see that changing anytime soon?
It's hard to say, but I do think that my sense is that there are a lot of Republicans who are not wanting to see a bunch of Dreamers get deported. They, like I was talking about before, it's just not really a politically popular thing to do. So I think that there would be more potential for something like that in the event that DACA ends, that they would do something. The question is what they would try to tie it to. So whether they would try to tie it to something that Democrats wouldn't go for. So I certainly don't think it's a guarantee that they would suddenly pass the Dream Act just because Trump ended DACA, but perhaps they could use some sort of stopgap measure, get more interest for that, or do something that ties, you know, Dreamer protections to something else.
Maria Sotomayor, if you could for just a moment, imagine what your life, well, tell us a little bit again, day to day, what your life is like, what you do, and imagine then, if you would, what that life might have been like without DACA.
Well, I don't have to imagine because I already had to live it through what it was like without DACA, right? Mm-hmm. Like I mentioned, well, DACA definitely gave me a protection against deportation and it made me feel a lot more confident about everything that I was doing. And also being able to apply for a position in an organization like the one where I work at and be able to do the work that I really love. But for many young people who maybe didn't have to deal with that because they are a lot younger and all they know is DACA, it's going to be really hard for them to get used to what it will be like being without being able to apply for a driver's license, without being able to apply to the job of their dreams or even go to college if that's what they want to do, and always having to look behind just to make sure that ICE is not coming for them. So it is really hard for many young people who got used to having this protection, and also a lot of them having able to work and having able to help their families, and whether it's like parents, siblings, or even their own families, since many are also parents. So it's going to be very hard.
Obviously talking about a huge difference in career opportunity.
And that as well, yes. I mean, our DACA recipients are in all types of different fields, and, you know, we have everything from teachers to business owners to people that are working in our homes, everything. So it will be a really huge change as well.
You also say, Maria, that immigrants, you know, including Dreamers, need to know their rights. What do you find people don't know that can jeopardize their status in the U.S.?
Of course. So we have been doing a lot of work statewide, teaching people about their rights, especially when it comes to immigration. A lot of people think because immigration agents are people with power that if they come to their house, they immediately have to open the door. And that is, you know, it's wrong. Like, unless they have a warrant under their name, then they don't need to open the door. Because a lot of times we have heard that ICE has overstepped their boundaries and came to look for somebody that used to live there before. And because they realize these other people who are living there now undocumented, they end up taking them as well when they weren't even looking for them. So we want our people to understand that, like, they have rights. And so we have also been giving out Know Your Rights cards so everybody in our communities can walk around with one of them if in case that they get stopped by an agent or police, that at least they know their rights. You know, the right to remain silent, to an attorney, not to sign anything without having an attorney present, and also a number that they can call, whether it's a local organization or their own attorney, to call if they are picked up by immigration.
And if they have any other questions, they can reach out to your organization, the Pennsylvania Immigration and Citizenship Coalition. Elise, one more quick question for you. What is the status of an idea being floated by the White House to Congress that would tie protection for Dreamers to funding for President Trump's border wall, smaller legal immigration numbers, and other provisions? Do we know?
As of now, Congress hasn't been back for a bit, so there's no real possibility of making big movement on that until they come back next week. But Democrats really shot that plan down, or that idea down, immediately. They said that, you know, Dreamers shouldn't be used as a bargaining chip. They shouldn't be held hostage. And I think that what people have to remember is there are a lot of things that were floated that are, you know, very, very extreme. Obviously, the Trump administration is pushing for them individually, but something like cutting legal immigration numbers dramatically, like the administration has proposed, is not something that could get, you know, significant Democratic support, if any. Just only one of these things. So I think that, you know, they say it would be dead on arrival. I think that that's probably true.
Elise Foley, thanks for being here. Elise is politics and immigration reporter for Huffington Post. Our thanks to Maria Sotomayor as well, deputy director of the Pennsylvania Immigration and Citizenship Coalition and a DACA recipient. And our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nouri. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you along for Radio Times. We'll be right back.